Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. I apologise once again, as I always do, that we're in the black hole of Calcutta again, but we've been pushed out of the committee room by a parliamentary committee, quite properly, I say. Yeah. Some years ago, I asked the Senator what he was going to do when he retired, and he said, "Wait for the Undertaker." This is not what we now call a positive attitude to retirement. In fact, more recently, there have been suggestions, including at the 2020 summit, there was a suggestion of, I can't remember what it was called, Golden Oldies or something, or Golden something or other, to make better use of the expertise of retired people. And contrary to what some people may think, retired members of Parliament have a great deal of expertise in many areas, and it would be useful to make use of that. Well, former Senator Margaret Reynolds, having ceased to be a senator, became a professor, which is an enormous increase in status. But in spite of being a professor, she has not been idle. She has been making use of her expertise in many areas. And we've invited her here today to tell us how former politicians can be useful. Please welcome her to the podium.
Thank you very much indeed, and it's lovely to be back again. And the topic I have really enjoyed trying to come to terms with, because there are a number of issues that I think as a society we should be addressing about utilising the skills and knowledge that parliamentarians do acquire by virtue of being in this place. When I was asked to give this lecture, I realised it would be almost to the day, just 10 years since I left the Senate. During those years, many changes have occurred in Australian politics. New governments, new policies, new ideas, new technology. However, for all that has changed, it is remarkable how many debates remain the same. As I read news reports, I often have a sense of déjà vu. Didn't I contribute to this call for policy reform 1, 2, 3 decades ago? Recently, I addressed a group of young women unionists who were actively campaigning for universal access to paid maternity leave. In preparing my speech to them, I sighed and recalled the detail of just so many campaigns that women of my generation had run for the last 40 years. I like to say that a little softly. I wondered why we had been so patient, so tolerant of those various economic arguments that insisted that Australia could not afford policies that have long been in place in other OECD countries. But at last, it seems, our voices have been heard, even if we still have to wait a while. One of the questions facing those of us who've been involved in public policy debate over several decades is how can we pass on that historic knowledge of past practice? It is very depressing to watch another generation simply reinvent the wheel, and sometimes not particularly successfully at that, and make the same mistakes that we made, resulting in policy change a decade ago. On one hand, it is essential to leave younger people to bring forward fresh ideas for new circumstances, and I certainly don't want to be guilty of saying that we shouldn't leave that to new ideas and another generation. But it is also important to incorporate the lessons learned from the past. In the 1960s, when I was working with a welfare organisation, I was given food vouchers to help Aboriginal families eat better quality food. At the time, I was highly embarrassed to accompany women and young children to the shop where a very censorious shopkeeper dictated which food could be purchased. In those years, I often bought a packet of sweets, biscuits, lollies or ice cream for the children because they were denied under the voucher scheme. But 40 years on, I'm appalled that modern policymakers have reintroduced this updated version of paternalism to quarantine part of the pension to be spent more appropriately. And I can't help wondering about the double standards involved. I wonder, for instance, how this would work here in the national capital if a proportion of public sector salaries were quarantined to protect people from making unwise or unhealthy decisions. Or is it only the poor who need guidance? This lecture gives me the chance to reflect on the directions I have taken in the last 10 years, and also to comment on the role former parliamentarians have in Australian communities and beyond. When I left the Senate, I had some clear plans about how I was going to move back into private life. I had a part-time position at the University of Queensland and was continuing some of my international work with both the Commonwealth and the United Nations. I was also packing up after 30 years in the tropics and moving back to our home state of Tasmania. However, what I was unprepared for was the shock of realising just how divorced many Australians are from their democracy. I had forgotten what it was like to be on the outside looking into the political world of decision making. And I began to realise just how much information I had personally absorbed about government and its influence on the community. Yet I was dismayed to learn how little people understood about their democracy and how the parliament works and how government interrelates to the parliament. As a nation, we pride ourselves on our long-standing system of governance, and of course we should celebrate that. Yet we are less committed to communicating just how the system functions and how citizens can actively participate in the process. I found that after years of closely monitoring and debating public policy, I now lived in a world where it was almost irrelevant. Now, please allow for a little bit of exaggeration, but in some circles, you know, when I tried to raise issues of public policy, people would say, oh, don't worry about it, it's not important. Many people are either disinterested or distrusting of the political process, while others have totally unrealistic expectations of how quickly reform can be achieved. It seems that many Australians, or too many anyway, are either dismissive of the political process or totally mystified about how the system actually works and how they can contribute. As a former teacher, I've always been interested in the link between education and active citizenship. While in the Parliament, I used to visit schools to introduce children of all ages to the basics of democracy. And instead of lecturing them on the facts and figures, I learnt to transform the classroom into a question time, complete with volunteer ministers and opposition members. And this was a very interesting exercise because it didn't matter where I did it, whether it was with quite young children or teenagers, it always worked if I was able to let the children or the young people run the agenda, because they discussed issues of concern to them. This method was popular because the children chose local topics and identified issues of direct relevance to them: the environment, road safety, health, food, sport and music were always on the agenda. I remember one occasion when a little girl very bravely, she was a quiet little girl, and she bravely volunteered to be a minister. And some of her classmates were sort of a bit, you know, superior about this little girl, especially the boys. And she looked a little bit worried. And I said, oh, that's great that you're going to be a minister. What would you like to be the minister of? And she said, I want to be the minister for hats. And that's exactly what happened. All the kids laughed and she looked very tearful and worried that she'd said the wrong thing. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Now, why do you want to be the Minister of Hats? She said, to stop skin cancer. And so all those kids who were laughing at her sort of suddenly, oh, she knows what she's talking about. And she was a very good minister for hats too. As a matter, as a nation, as in my post-parliamentary life, I worked in East Timor, Fiji and Africa, where I extended this model to give women an understanding of decision-making at local, national and international levels. In Dili, I was there for 3 weeks working on a pre-election campaign to help women prepare for their first experience of the democratic process, whether as voters, workers or as candidates. We role-played a variety of situations, including how women candidates might respond to pressures from family, church and male colleagues. And that was a wonderful learning experience for me to see the intensity by which those women were so engaged in wanting to be part of this new thing called democracy. In Africa, I worked with women from around the Commonwealth as we planned to feminise the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Quite a challenge, that is. And in Fiji, women from the South Pacific developed their own system of government, complete with a women's cabinet. And guess what? I played the role of a token male. I played it quite well, as you can imagine, with a little bit of experience. Back in Australia, I focused on young people in schools and universities, encouraging them to get involved and be less cynical about the political process. In Australia, I think because we take our democracy for granted, we do have too many people who are cynical, and we may not be able to change an older generation that's cynical, but we certainly can change the younger generation, because they're our future leaders. In 1999, I organised in the Queensland Parliament a youth reconciliation parliament where 50 teenagers were selected from around the state on the basis of their submitted speeches to participate in this memorable event. So we had a competition, we received a couple of hundred entries, and we had an independent judging panel, and 50 were chosen and funded to come to the capital for this event. Listening to their insights into Australian race relations, I could not but wish that their views were echoed in the corridors of power in Canberra at that time. Their knowledge, wisdom and passion put many of us to shame as they reached out for real solutions to historic failure. As preparations were underway to mark the centenary of Federation in 2001, I wondered how relevant that occasion was for many Australians and how they would see that as a democratic landmark. How could local communities be involved in such a remote event? There was a grand occasion in Melbourne and there were speeches and lectures during that year. But how could we reach out to use the Centenary of Federation as an opportunity to talk to people in the community about the value of our democracy? My answer came in the form of 26 youth parliaments to be held in each Tasmanian local government area. At the time, only a few councils seriously engaged with young people, and I wanted to bring young people into a project that combined understanding of the democratic process with the reality of life in local communities. I talked with councils about each sponsoring a May Youth Parliament in their chambers to coincide with the celebrations in Melbourne. And I worked with the state government on this project, and they said, Margaret, you can't do it. You won't be able to do it, not with local government. There's nothing like telling me that you can't do something for me to prove that it can be done. And the councils were wonderful. They were absolutely fantastic. They didn't organise them all in May because there were a number of logistical issues, but they did all reach out to their young citizens, and those 26 youth parliaments were held. It was not an easy task, and timing changed in different areas of the state. However, I was greatly assisted by the Tasmanian Speaker of the Legislative Assembly, who agreed to invite representatives of each youth parliament to a special session of the Tasmanian Parliament later that year. This encouraged all councils to get involved so that by October, each council had two representatives who travelled to Hobart for the grand occasion when four teenagers, elected by their peers from each geographic region of the state, actually addressed the assembled Tasmanian Parliament. Standing orders were suspended for the occasion, and this had only happened once before on the occasion of a formal parliamentary apology when Aboriginal elders had addressed the Parliament. On this occasion, the government and opposition members listened for an hour as student speakers outlined their concerns for the future. In a follow-up ceremony, 52 representatives from around the state presented the then Premier, Jim Bacon, with their submissions, and each received a formal response at a later stage detailing government policy. This model is probably unique, and its impact translated into many more Tasmanians being aware and interested in the Centenary of Federation because it involved their young people talking about local issues and being proactive in presenting them to the government. Once I became focused on this linkage between the democratic process and active citizenship, I could see so many opportunities to engage my students at university and local communities in better understanding of their place. In my human rights classes, we role-played the United Nations, various United Nations forums and tribunals, and to coincide with the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which was held in Brisbane, eventually at the Sunshine Coast, we held a model CHOGM, which was an open forum attended by a number of senior school students. Tertiary students planned the event and each adopted a country to represent. Some dressed up for the occasion, which included a colourful parade and opening ceremony. Now, the funny part about this particular occasion was at the time there was a very active group on campus that were opposed to CHOGM. It was a group of student protesters, and they wanted more money spent on alleviating poverty and the environment, and so they were wanting to campaign against CHOGM. And of course, my students were, I think, more aware of some of the things that were actually happening at the Commonwealth level. But on the day of our CHOGM, one of my students came rushing in and said, there's going to be a protest. And I said, what do you mean? There's going to be a protest at our CHOGM. So we had, sure enough, we went to the occasion, and there were about 30 activists from the student community wanting to protest about the student CHOGM. And so I thought they had bells and whistles, and I thought they were going to make quite a bit of noise. And we had, there were about 150 tertiary students involved, plus about the same number of school students. So I didn't really, I know I'm all for free speech, but I didn't really want all the speeches drowned out by the noise of the protesters. So I thought, what do? I'll invite them in. So I asked them if they would like to come and put their point of view at the student CHOGM. They were amazed, my students were amazed, but we didn't have a great deal of interruption as we might have had otherwise. During this period, I was president of the United Nations Association of Australia, at a time when Australia's reputation was under close scrutiny for its arbitrary detention policies. I encouraged many refugee advocates to put forward the traumatic experience of detainees, and under the UNAA banner, we prepared three reports to present to the United Nations Human Rights Commission in Geneva over the period 2002 to 2004. I well remember the reaction of delegates from a number of nations who did not understand why a country like Australia could not manage to accommodate comparatively small numbers of asylum seekers without resorting to punitive policies in isolated desert camps. One year, a group of students accompanied me to Geneva, where they spoke to delegates and learned firsthand just how damaging that debate was at the time to Australia's international reputation as a responsible global citizen. In 2004, I accepted a position in Tasmania with National Disability Services, which is Australia's peak organisation representing disability service providers. My role was to work with non-government disability service providers and the state government to ensure that people with disabilities were able to exercise their rights as citizens. I worked in a small office with limited resources and high expectations of what needed to change in getting a fair go for Tasmanians with disabilities. Having grown up in Tasmania, a very small and friendly state, as I know Jocelyn will know, I knew many people now in influential positions. As a youngster, I'd played beach cricket with the governor. I'd had a teenage date, with a prominent member of the Liberal opposition, and I knew most of the members of the Labor government by their first names. I was not sure that this local knowledge would necessarily assist me, but it was certainly a good start in finding my way around a system very much in need of reform. The situation at state level mirrored that at national, that many reforms associated with initiatives in the 1980s and the 1990s had started to be taken for granted without a specific injection of resources or updating of policy locally. While Tasmania was the first state to close its mental institution and offer intellectually disabled people the opportunity to live in the community, there had been limited thought given to the impact this would have on available revenue. Dollars saved in closing the institution went back into consolidated revenue and could not be traced for use in new service provision. Waiting lists had continued to grow, and service providers were under considerable pressure to respond in situations of continual crisis management. However, in the last 12 months, Tasmania has moved towards a new model of reform and integrated disability access planning across all government departments. And I think much of that innovation will be something that other states may well want to watch closely. Many of the strategies that I've used to assist bring about these changes in this particular job have been adapted from my experience in the Senate. I focused on budgetary decision making, including attending the annual budget lockup and the estimates hearings, and preparing what I called disability impact statements on the state budget. One year, we even challenged funding processes by appealing to the Auditor General, a decision that was not well received by some of my former Labor colleagues and friends, but was absolutely essential in trying to track just how the disability dollar was spent to increase the availability of services for people so in need. At the same time, I was working to build a tripartisan network of support in the Parliament to put disability rights firmly on the political agenda. And one of the nicest things that happened just recently, when there was a bit of a kerfuffle about something that the government, the Labor government, had not done at the local level, was that a certain person rang me and said, "Oh, I thought we could trust you, but you just talk to your friends in the Liberal Party." And I thought, well, that's my job now, to work across the political spectrum. Many Australians assume that their former elected representatives fade into their communities and have no specific responsibility once they leave public life. But is this true? Should we exile those who have so contributed to a period of public policy debate as no longer having an ongoing role to contribute aspects of their knowledge and experience? Former prime ministers continue to have access to an office, staff and travel, as do a number of former ministers and parliamentarians. Not the office and staff, but the travel. And it is assumed that certainly the former prime ministers will continue to contribute to public debate based on their experience as leaders. Some state premiers and former ministers take on paid or voluntary positions, which enable them to focus on specific areas of public policy. Some former parliamentarians use their contacts and knowledge of the political process to become lobbyists, while others look for positions of influence on public and private sector boards of management. Increasingly, a number of former parliamentarians are offered positions in academia. Some move to the international arena, and some take on new challenges that bear no resemblance to their former careers in public policy. A few write their memoirs or contribute to public debate through lecturing and writing. Should the Australian community have any specific expectations of their former elected representatives? Is it reasonable to expect that the public investment in the democratic process may extend beyond those years when individuals are paid to actually represent the Australian people? These days, parliamentary life may only occupy a small proportion of a working life. The average age of sitting parliamentarians is much lower than in the days when mainly men were elected in middle age and retired late in life. Today's parliamentarians are younger and may have two or three careers ahead of them when they depart the political stage. Parliamentary superannuation, even under the new guidelines, is, I believe, quite generous. Those who are defeated in elections are often disadvantaged in the workplace because they are seen as no longer having the influence they once enjoyed. This is especially true if there is a change of government. Australian parliamentarians are, by definition, party animals, so their partisan loyalties may not necessarily assist in finding a new career. Those who retire from Parliament by choice may already have lined up new careers, taking advantage of in-house contacts and opportunities. Others may specifically choose positions in the corporate sector where their political insights may be of particular value. Should there be any limits to taking the knowledge and benefits of parliamentary experience into the marketplace to be sold off to the highest bidder? It is a standard refrain of many parliamentarians that they have retired to spend more time with their families. But I've never heard of anyone who actually said they were going to spend more time with their community. Yet elected representatives have learned so much about their community and have spent a great deal of time working to enhance community life. So how can this experience be utilised when an individual returns to life as a private citizen? When I was leaving the Senate in 1999, I did wonder how I would adjust to a very different lifestyle. I had been in public life, if I count local government, for 20 years and expected to actively participate in a range of current social debates. I was used to being asked my opinion and commenting in the media. I expected to be invited to numerous official functions as I had become an expert at cutting ribbons and unveiling plaques, if not kissing babies. I had detailed itineraries planned months in advance and was used to travelling across the continent and indeed overseas. I could make impromptu speeches on almost any topic and kept an anecdote book to lighten some of the prepared speeches that I had to deliver on behalf of ministers. How could I respond to a quieter life in regional Tasmania? Would I suffer from the condition that Gareth Evans so memorably described when we as the government became opposition in 1996, that is, relevance deprivation syndrome? My first challenge in leaving the Senate was to keep in check my partisan view of political issues. after spending all those years asserting the philosophy and policies of the Australian Labor Party, I found myself lecturing students at the University of Queensland, where I knew I had a responsibility to present a balanced perspective and encourage open debate. I was teaching human rights and international politics, so thought I would not necessarily stray into Australian politics. However, within the first months, I found myself praising the Howard government's initiatives in East Timor and trying to explain my own party's failure over 20 years to protect the East Timorese. Working in a university after life in Parliament highlighted the gulf that exists between these two institutions. When, as a parliamentarian, I was involved in public policy development, there was limited referral to those whose research may have enhanced practical policy implementation. Yet within academia itself, I found there was equal disinterest or misunderstanding about the challenges that parliamentarians face in finding solutions to complex issues. Too many academics appear to be so narrowly focused on specific areas of research that they are often unable to contribute to public debate. But equally, too many parliamentarians adopt such a generic view of the world that they fail to draw on the expertise available in our tertiary institutions. There certainly should be a more proactive way to encourage a realistic exchange that would be of great benefit to the community. And while I promised not to make any political comment here this morning, you'd have to say that regardless of your views, the fact that Steve Fielding has come up with wanting to question certain aspects of a given policy that we won't talk about in detail, but you know, he did ask for experts to come in and brief him on, I guess, two sides of the debate. In each of my post-parliamentary roles, I have been very aware and appreciative of the lessons I learned as a senator and a minister. I have seen firsthand how government and the parliament function. I know the systems and processes and how to work at a local, state, national and international level. I understand the intricacies of lobbying effectively and how to use the media to get issues onto the political agenda. I also know the frustrations of trying to get certain policy issues fully debated and acted upon. Anyone elected to the Parliament acquires this knowledge, but it is not until we leave that we realise just how valuable it is. And certainly, senators are particularly advantaged in having sat through many hours of Senate estimates hearings when we learn so much about government and interdepartmental processes, or lack of them. And I also found that the Senate estimates process, especially educational in understanding the tensions between the political and bureaucratic processes. I remember one very special occasion when, with Kay Patterson, we challenged the department, and I'm not sure what it was called in those days, but it was responsible for aged care policy. And Kay and I talked in the break about some of the questions and answers we were getting. And it was when there had been an introduction of more paperwork for staff in aged care nursing homes. And it meant that they just did not have the time to spend with their clients. And there was a lot of unhappiness from nursing home staff. And Kay and I were aware of this, so we decided to follow up. And we were trying to find out, you know, who had made this decision, because the department, the aged care people, seemed to be a bit twitchy about it. We got the distinct impression that they didn't agree with it either. And finally, I think it was Kay who said, well, you know, was this a policy initiative of yours, or did it come from somewhere else? Did it come from finance? And suddenly, at the back of the room, we saw these two gentlemen tiptoeing out of the room. They were from finance. And I saw them, and I said to Kay later, they were here. will ask for them to come and appear before estimates, which they did. And one of the questions that we asked was, had they ever visited a nursing home? Of course, they hadn't. So, I mean, the learning experience in estimates is just invaluable in understanding how the system works or not, as the case may be. My experience working in various communities has convinced me that we cannot really, here in Australia, boast about our status as an effective democracy until we succeed in engaging more citizens in its processes. This is especially important for young people and less advantaged citizens. So many people in the Australian community have so little control over their lives because other people are making decisions for them. And this is particularly so in Aboriginal communities, in migrant communities, among older people, particularly in nursing homes, and particularly in the area where I'm working at the moment, in disability. And I think that all parliamentarians are concerned to create a better understanding of our democratic institutions, but they need to reach out a little bit more to these particularly disadvantaged groups. And perhaps some may choose to take on that additional challenge when they leave the parliament, well equipped to enhance the level of understanding of Australia's democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that, Margaret. We have some time for questions. Would anybody like to ask any questions? Perhaps I could start the ball rolling. I don't often do this, you know. What do you think of the idea of some sort of formal arrangement, as was I think was suggested at the 2020 summit, of some sort of formal scheme for drawing on not only retired politicians, but people retired from other areas to act as mentors and so on in particular areas?
I think it's a great idea, and I remember reading about it after the 2020 summit. And I think that there is that tendency for each generation to try to bring about change, and sometimes we succeed and sometimes we don't. And if we don't share the experience, it just makes it harder for the next generation. So I certainly think that there should be that suggestion that came through at the 2020 summit should be followed up on.
A question over here.
Hello, my name is Sheila Kernan, and you're talking about democracy. I think it's a bit like the tail wagging the dog or whatever. There's this occasion when, right now on the news, where she took her baby, this senator. I mean, she's pushing the envelope, really, isn't she? Now, I believe there are some situations, perhaps in the, what would you say, it's not good to throw away all the old rules. I know the younger ones are pushing the envelope, but they're trying to throw away everything. And I really personally feel that she's doing more harm than good for females, the way she's doing it. I mean, she could have put the baby, given it to someone else, or not even gone in. But it annoyed me, because I don't think she's doing us any favours. It's the opposite, actually. So I'm saying that we can take some of the things that the younger people are giving us, and I've endorsed them myself. I've even learnt computer and everything like that, so I'm up with the modern, you know. But you've got to keep some of the old.
True.
And
it's a balance, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. I was a bit annoyed with this senator for doing it.
Look, I think it is a very... the particular experience in the Senate last night is divisive. Some people have your view, others say, well, why shouldn't she? I mean, the reality for those of us who know how the Senate works, I mean, we know there are standing orders and there are certain things you can do and there are certain things you can't do. And strangers, I think the term is still strangers.
No.
We don't have strangers anymore.
Did away with that 20 years ago.
Oh, good. Can't be on the floor of the Senate because they haven't been elected. I think you need a little bit of flexibility if there was an emergency. I mean, apparently there is now childcare in Parliament House. That's wonderful. And but you do need a little bit of flexibility if there's an emergency. I guess there wouldn't be too many parents who haven't had, you know, an emergency where they say, what do we do with the children?
Someone outside the door before she walked in.
Sure. I understand.
I'm tempted to say this subject is now closed. But I won't. Now, other questions. Could I ask you to go to the microphone so that your question can be recorded? Well, I think the lady in this row here had her hand up first, so can I give precedence to the lady who first caught my eye?
Margaret, a democracy only functions properly if the community is aware, politically aware. I don't think the average Australian is particularly interested or aware of what goes on. What can we do about this?
Well, my answer would be to ensure that real political education is in the curriculum, but of every school. I mean, it is in some areas and it's done extremely well, but it's very much a hit and miss affair. I remember one of these youth parliaments I ran in a particular school was absolutely spoiled by teachers saying, because you walk in, you don't know the children, you depend on the children to respond to you. And this little boy volunteered to be the president. I think we were doing a Senate that day, and he volunteered to be the president and, with my help, conduct question time. And a teacher came up and put her hand on his shoulder and said, "Oh, Jimmy, you couldn't possibly do that." And I was absolutely floored. I didn't know what to do because, you know, the kids was crestfallen and he'd volunteered. And so, but was I supposed to go against the teacher? And so I said, "Oh, I'm sure we'll manage together." And he became the president. He was great. He just needed that opportunity to show that, you know, he could make a contribution. But that perhaps he was very bad at his, his arithmetic or whatever he was doing. But we tend in too many classes to try to control and manage how children will respond. I know there's a great concern about partisanship, and when I used to run my this is one of the reasons I developed this model, because I used to think, well, how can I do it so that it's not about, you know, Labor, Liberal, National Party and Greens? And that's why I developed this idea of a question time based on children's issues and understanding. I think we should do much more of that when they're very young and then gradually change it, obviously, so they understand the various processes as they go through high school and into university. But I can say that I basically agree with you that it was only when I went back into a lot more community activity that I thought, gosh, people just don't understand what they've got, you know, the value of our democracy. And especially the cynicism really upsets me because It's all so unfair to the, in politics you have your debates and your arguments with people, and there are some people you are more likely to agree with than others. But once you get outside, you do appreciate just how much work and how much commitment everyone who is elected is prepared to give.
It's been commented by people in the Parliamentary Education Office that teachers are intimidated by the system.
Yes, I think that's...
It could be an example of that.
Teachers are very worried that they will be accused of being partisan. And I know I got more invitations than perhaps I should have, because teachers thought, oh, thank goodness, someone else can do this. And yet they were asking a Labor senator. But the fact that I was a Labor senator was irrelevant because of the way we did it. You know, I don't think politics, party politics was mentioned.
Now, a question over on my left here.
Could I give a little background for my question? I wonder if we were in USA or the last election in England of a week ago, that we would have found an indifference. Now, with that as a background, it amazes me we don't have something to say. And who do you say where is the body buried? Now, the Greeks have given us a very funny thing. They've given us the language that we've thrown away. One is to find out who are the oligarchs, and I'm talking of what the oligarchs of Melbourne have done against Tasmanian football. And if you think I'm raising something that's not known, this is on the sports pages. So I'm still wanting to find out who the oligarchs in Melbourne are that are taking away my football teams from the rest of Australia. That's number one question. The second one is the other Greeks have given us a word called ostracism. And I'm wondering, in all of your talks and all the background, have you ever given a lecture on the Greeks' ostracism?
I'm not sure whether there's a question there.
I don't, well, I'm not particularly well qualified to talk about football, but I agree with your, you know, your general sentiments. In terms of have I ever given a lecture on ostracism? No, but I certainly have experienced ostracism at times in my political life.
Now, another question.
Chris Klugman, Civil Liberties. I'd just like to commend Margaret on her active life after politics. I think it's a terrific example. We do invest a lot of time and public money into members of Parliament. I think it's very creditable to you that you've gone on, and particularly the education, democracy and people's rights. You mentioned Fair Go with disabilities. I think people knowing their rights is incredibly important, and having education that's relevant to young people and being able to work with people with disabilities and giving them a fair go, I'd just like to express my admiration, and I think you're doing a terrific job. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I didn't detect a question there. Now, was there another question? Would you like to trot across to the microphone so we can record your question?
My name's Helen Pilkington. I'd just like to ask if you could reflect a bit more on how we include Australian citizens who are Indigenous in our political conversation. There's been a lot of discussion about this around the intervention. Thank you.
Yes. Well, look, it's a very good question, and I've got a very good example of how involved Indigenous communities can be in something that directly affects them, which really is why we get involved in the first place, because we feel direct. I mean, before we go into Parliament and represent other people or speak up for other people if we're citizens, but before that step, we are engaged because we suddenly think of something that affects us or our families or someone close to us, and we think that's not fair. That's really what drives, you know, most people. We've got to do something about it. Now, in terms of Indigenous communities, a number of years ago, there was an issue affecting Indigenous communities. It related to native title legislation. And at the time, I was involved at the United Nations as a parliamentary representative with former Senator Kay Patterson. And I went to visit a number of Aboriginal communities in North Queensland and the Northern Territory, thinking where I'd been at the United Nations, where I was actually doing a bit of work on the convention relating to Indigenous people, the UN convention. But I thought to myself, how am I going to talk about this? You know, the United Nations is there and people are concerned about something that affects them in these very isolated communities. I got there and one of the first questions from one of the community was, had I been talking about the convention for have you been talking about that paper about convention for Indigenous people? Now, the language was not directly correct, whatever that means, but the awareness was there because it was being debated in local communities. And I think we underestimate many remote communities, be they Indigenous, be they remote in terms of geographic or in terms of educational levels. If people are concerned about issues that directly impact on them, we should be able to involve them in the debate instead of making decisions for them. I don't think we're doing nearly enough in terms of, you know, 10 years on, 20 years on, in terms of involving Indigenous people in political debate. It's not that they're not interested or they're not part of it. We're not listening.
Okay, any other questions before we wrap up? Before we go, I'll let you in on a little secret. When Margaret was here as a senator, we have various ways of classifying senators so that when they appear, you know, a signal flashes up. And when then Senator Reynolds appeared, the signal that flashed up was above partisanship, because she was regarded as one of those people who was a partisan politician but capable of getting outside of it. So that's just a little secret of clerkly experience I'll let you in on. Please join me in thanking her for an excellent lecture.